Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on July 25, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. On today's call, we'll be discussing developments in public use law, looking at KELO, but also subsequent litigation and legislation, looking at both the federal and state levels. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very happy today to have two experts on our call, and as in the past, their complete bios have been provided to you in the notice of today's call and are also available on the Federalist Society's website. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our panelists, about 10 to 12 minutes from each, and then maybe a little bit of back and forth, and then we'll get to the questions from the audience. We'll hear first from Professor James W. Ely, Jr., who is the Milton R. Underwood Professor of Law Emeritus at Vanderbilt University Law School. As I mentioned, he's going to speak for 10 to 12 minutes. Then we'll hear from Professor Ilya Soman, Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law, and also one of the longtime practice group leaders. Let's get right to the program. And with that, Professor Ely, your opening remarks, please.
Fine. Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be on the program today. I hope to take a few minutes to place the current debate over the public use clause in the Fifth Amendment within a broader historic context. Protection for the rights of property owners was long a central tenet in Anglo-American constitutionalism. John Locke had famously observed that the great and chief end of government is the preservation of property. Leading commentators for many decades stressed the high regard that which should be accorded property rights. The third absolute right inherent in every Englishman, William Blackstone declared on the eve of the American Revolution, is that of property, which consists in the free use, enjoyment, and disposal of all his acquisitions without any control or diminution, save only by the laws of the land. As we know, both Locke and Blackstone were highly influential with the founding generation. The desire to better secure property rights was a major factor in both the break from Great Britain and in the framing of the Constitution. Political leaders over and again stressed the importance of property in a free society and saw liberty and property as inseparable. Property must be secured, John Adams succinctly insisted in 1790, or liberty cannot exist. Accordingly, the Constitution and Bill of Rights contain a number of provisions to safeguard property, but our focus today is on the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment. That provision implicitly recognized the power of government to acquire private property by eminent domain, but cabined that authority by requiring that property must be taken for public use and only upon payment of just compensation. The Supreme Court had little opportunity to address the question of what amounts to public use in the 19th century. But individual justices early expressed the view that the taking of property for private advantage was forbidden. In 1795, William Paterson, who incidentally had been a member of the Philadelphia Convention, maintained that eminent domain, which he termed the despotic power, did not authorize the redistribution of property to private parties. 3 years later, Justice Samuel Chase, in often quoted language, concluded that a law that takes property from A and gives it to B cannot be considered a rightful exercise of legislative authority. For the most part, state courts during the 19th century read public use fairly strictly. One example must suffice. In 1843, a New York court struck down a state law authorizing the establishment of a private road over the land of another. prominent treatise writers, Thomas M. Cooley, John Lewis, asserted that public use meant possession and enjoyment of the property by the public, not a vague and indirect public benefit. Moreover, it was generally believed that the determination of public use was a constitutional question for the judiciary. In other words, a legislature could not make a use public simply by declaring it to be so. It warrants emphasis that public use should not be equated with public ownership. It has long been the view that lawmakers could delegate to private parties the power to take property for public use. The classic example was the widespread delegation of eminent domain power to railroads in the 19th century. Such delegation was generally sustained because railroads were common carriers and had special obligations to serve the public. Yet, by the end of the 19th century, some state courts began to adopt a broader reading of the power of government to take property, defining public use in terms of the more expansive notions of public benefit or public interest. Further, judicial review of legislative determinations of public use grew increasingly slack, with courts simply deferring to the legislature. This trend was hastened by the progressive movement of the early 20th century. Dismissive of claims of individual rights, the progressives sought to strengthen government in order to regulate the economy and achieve their vision of the common good. Manifesting great faith in the ability of an educated elite to plan the economy and manage society, they called for judicial deference to legislative decisions. The progressives laid the intellectual groundwork for a jurisprudence which largely stripped property of constitutional protection, an agenda that was ultimately brought to fruition by the New Deal Supreme Court in the late 1930s and 1940s. In the face of this intellectual change, the significance of the public use requirement steadily eroded. Indeed, in a line of cases, the post-New Deal Supreme Court has come close to reading the public use limitation out of the Constitution, at least at the federal level. In 1954, and a very important example of this point, in Berman v. Parker, the justices upheld the taking of land from one private owner for transfer to another as part of an urban renewal plan for the District of Columbia. Justice Douglas stressed that the role of the judiciary in a public use inquiry was extremely narrow, and that a legislative declaration of public interest was, in his phrase, well nigh conclusive. Reflecting the spirit of the progressives, Douglas gave great weight to the views of urban planners and experts. 30 years later, the court went a step further in Hawaii Housing Authority v. Midkiff, sustaining a land redistribution scheme to overcome the perceived problem of concentrated land ownership in that island state. Now the court indicated that it would uphold any exercise of eminent domain, again here I must quote, rationally related to a conceivable public purpose. One might ask, what acquisition by government would not meet this open-ended test? Many state courts followed the Supreme Court's lead, with the Michigan Supreme Court in the notorious Poletown case allowing the taking of property for economic development purposes by private enterprise. The Berman and Midkiff decisions did not arouse much public interest, and localities increasingly utilized eminent domain in ever more aggressive ways for large-scale projects in which the public interest was indirect and highly conjectural. The Supreme Court's decision in Kelo, the City of New London, which was rendered in 2005, it validated the exercise of eminent domain to condemn non-blighted residences for transfer to private developers. This, I think, decision marked something of a turning point. Not only did four justices forcefully dissent, but for the first time, average homeowners realized that they were vulnerable to the exercise of eminent domain. Two further comments are in order with respect to Kelo. First, the majority opinion by Justice Stevens, in a bow to the progressives, repeatedly emphasized the supposed existence of a comprehensive development plan by the City of New London. It is open to serious question whether there was in fact such a plan in New London. But in any event, planning is not a substitute for meaningful judicial review. Second, although disappointing in many respects, Kelo had one positive consequence. It did much to restore the rights of property owners to the public dialogue and sparked, as I know Ilya will describe, a considerable legislative and judicial reaction. In conclusion, I would like to say a brief word about the practical consequences of large-scale exercise of eminent domain. It is all too easy for developers to conjure up grandiose images of economic growth. But the reality is that such projects, as in Poletown, as in Midkiff, and as in Kelo, often fail to deliver the promised benefits. Even more troublesome, as Justice Thomas pointed out in his Kelo dissent, it is often the poor and racial minorities who are displaced to make room for these allegedly grand projects. Well, with that thumbnail sketch about the history of the public use requirement, I will turn things over to Ilya.
I'd like to thank Jim for his excellent discussion of the history of public use and how we got to the point where the Supreme Court decided Kelo. I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society for organizing this event and all of you for listening. Finally, last but not least, I'd like to thank the Supreme Court for deciding the Kelo decision, because although I think they got it wrong, it's been very good for those of us who study this area of property law. I got numerous articles out of it. It helped me get tenure. I now have a book contract, write a book about it. So I say to them, if possible, can they please keep up the bad work, because some of us have to make a living writing about it. So in my presentation today, I'm going to talk about the reaction that Kelo generated, which in many ways was unprecedented. Public opinion surveys in the aftermath of the decision showed that over 80% of the public disapproved. And in addition, some 44 states have passed eminent domain reform laws in the aftermath of Kelo, which is a record. No other Supreme Court decision has ever generated as much responsive state legislation as Kelo has. Kelo has also led to a great deal of litigation in federal and state courts, and I'll talk a little bit about that as well. So I'll start with the legislative reaction. When a record 44 states passed these new laws, or when this tide of laws first began coming, many people argued, well, we don't really need judicial protection for property rights in such cases because the legislature will take care of it. And in some states, that did indeed happen, but in all too many, what seemed like it would be effective reform was in reality just for show. So 36 states have passed reform laws through the ordinary legislative process. But of those 36, 21 are largely ineffective in the sense that they don't really provide meaningful protection for property owners. There are different reasons why they're ineffective, but the most common one is that the legislation says that you can't take private property from one individual and give it to another private entity if it's for economic development, but then they also say, but you can do it if the property is blighted. And then they defined blight so broadly that virtually any property anywhere in the world can in fact be considered blighted under that definition. For instance, under definitions like this, such places as Times Square in New York and downtown Las Vegas have been declared blighted by courts. And obviously, if those places are blighted, so is pretty much any other location that the government or influential private interests might want to condemn. There have been, however, more effective laws passed by referendum. 13 states have enacted new laws by referendum, including some that also enacted legislative reforms. And of those, 9 are likely to be effective, including especially 6 out of 7 that were passed in citizen-initiated referenda. That is, referendum questions that are drafted by private citizen groups who can then place them on the ballot by gathering signatures. In contrast, legislatively initiated referendum questions, ones that are first drafted by the legislature and have to get through the legislature, are on average somewhat less effective. So this pattern of legislative reactions raises 3 interesting questions. One is, why was there such a big public reaction at all? As Jim mentioned, even before QO, the Supreme Court decisions were very favorable to a broad interpretation of public use. Second, why were so many of the laws enacted and effective? And third, why is it that citizen-initiated referenda were so much more likely to actually produce strong reforms than laws that had to go through the state legislature? I think there are a number of different reasons why we have this pattern, but one big one is, I think, a pattern of public ignorance, of the public actually often not being aware of what's going on in this area of law. In a survey conducted by the SAINT Index, which does studies of public opinion on land use issues, I was able to get them to put a couple of my questions into the survey, and they found that actually only 13% of the public both knew whether or not their state had passed an eminent domain reform law since QO and were able to tell whether it was effective or not. And that 13% is perhaps an overestimate of the true level of knowledge because of the fact that some people probably got the right answer by guessing. People do tend to guess on surveys in some cases rather than admit that they don't know something. So given that people often have difficulty telling the difference between effective and ineffective reform laws, it's not surprising that some state legislatures would take advantage of that ignorance and would pass laws that pretend to do something but actually don't, thereby appeasing public opinion, but also avoiding angering powerful interest groups that benefit from the status quo. I think ignorance also helps account for why there was such a big public reaction to QO in the first place. While experts in eminent domain law knew about the Berman decision, the Midkiff decision, and so forth, most of the general public did not. And as a result, it came as a shock to them to find out that Supreme Court precedent allowed the condemnation not only of so-called genuinely blighted neighborhoods, but even of ordinary lower middle class homes, as occurred in the QO case itself. And obviously, this was shocking to the public, even if experts in the field were not surprised. Finally, why is it that citizen-initiated referenda are more effective on average? Well, it's not necessarily because the public knows more about referenda than they knew about ordinary legislation. It's rather a question of who writes these laws. In the legislature, when legislators write them, they have, on the one hand, some desire to satisfy public opinion, but on the other hand, they also want to satisfy powerful interest groups such as developers, local governments, and others who benefit from the status quo. Obviously, with citizen-initiated referenda, the people who write these questions, for the most part, are not running for election. They don't necessarily care if they anger interest groups, and usually they're actually strong property rights advocates, so they write stronger reforms, which then pass. The one exception to this rule is actually an exception that proves the rule. The one ineffective citizen-initiated referendum that was passed is California Proposition 99, which was actually drafted by the California League of Cities. As the name implies, the CLC is actually an organization of California local governments, the very people who wield these eminent domain powers that supposedly would be limited by Prop 99, so it's understandable that they didn't really want to limit them at all. You might ask, well, why did they put Prop 99 on the ballot in the first place? And the answer is that they did it to preempt Proposition 89, another ballot measure which was on the California ballot the same year, which was put there by property rights advocates. Proposition 99, put there by the League of Cities, even included a provision saying that it would override Proposition 89 if both of them passed at the same time. So it was, in a sense, a kind of Trojan horse initiative, and it's a kind of exception that really does prove the rule. Now, in addition to the major political reaction generated by QO, QO has also led to a lot of litigation in the lower courts. And in particular, in the aftermath of QO, a number of state Supreme Courts have considered whether QO's interpretation of the federal public use clause should govern their own interpretations of the public use clauses of their state constitutions. And so far, the answer to that question has, generally speaking, been no. The states of Ohio, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Hawaii, in their state Supreme Courts, they've all repudiated QO directly as an interpretation or as a guide to the interpretation of their state constitutions. And some other state Supreme Courts, like Rhode Island and Maryland, while not directly ruling on the question of whether QO applies in their state, they have limited eminent domain authority in various ways that are probably inconsistent with QO and its policy of extreme deference to whatever the legislature and city planners might do. There is a significant outlier to this judicial trend, which is the New York Court of Appeals, which, despite the name, is actually the highest court of New York. In addition to issuing dubious decisions in the New York courts, they also have very confusing nomenclature. In two state Supreme Court decisions in New York, the Atlantic Yards case and the Cower case, the New York Court of Appeals allowed sweeping use of eminent domain power, which in some ways goes even further than QO does. In both of these cases, powerful private interests played a big role in generating the takings. In the Atlantic Yards case, the influential developer Bruce Ratner. In Cower, in Columbia, it was Columbia University, which got the land and was the driving force behind the takings. And these decisions all had three very troubling aspects. First, they all involved declarations of blight, but they defined blight so broadly that virtually any area could be considered blighted. In particular, they said it was any area that's, quote, economically underdeveloped, or even where there could be reasonable disagreement over whether it was underdeveloped. I would maintain to you there's no piece of land anywhere in the world where you couldn't have some disagreement over whether it could be developed further than it presently is. Secondly, the studies that were used to supposedly prove that the area was blighted was in fact conducted by a firm that in each case was actually on the payroll of the very entity, Bruce Ratner or Columbia University, that would get the land if it was condemned. So there was a fundamental conflict of interest here. And third, in both cases, there's substantial evidence that much of the blight that was used to justify the condemnation in the first place was actually on property in the area that was already owned, in one case by Ratner's firm and in the other case by Columbia. So Ratner and Columbia quite possibly actually allowed some blight to develop on their own property so they could then use that circumstance as a justification for seizing other property in the area through eminent domain. So you have here a level of a kind of corruption that goes beyond even what you see in other states, which have a very permissive approach to takings. However, it bears emphasis that most state Supreme Courts have in fact gone the other way on this so far in the aftermath of Kelo and have not adopted Kelo as a guide to the interpretation of their state constitutions. Finally, while Kelo in general was highly deferential and allowed legislatures to authorize takings for any reason, it did reiterate the traditional view that takings that are, quote, pretextual are still unconstitutional, a pretextual taking being one where the official motive for the taking was in reality some kind of a pretext for some other nefarious purpose, like benefiting a private interest. Now, how do we know whether a taking is pretextual or not? The Kelo court gives us relatively little guidance on this. And in the aftermath of Kelo, lower courts have actually split five different ways on this issue. Some lower courts have said that what you have to do is focus on pretextual motive, show whether the condemning authority had the purpose of benefiting a private interest. A couple of state Supreme Courts have said this. A second possible approach is to look at the distribution of the benefits of the taking. Do most of the benefits go to some one particular private interest? A third, following some language in Kelo, focuses on whether there was any kind of careful planning of the taking ahead of time, with the idea that if there was not careful planning, that suggests it might be pretextual. Fourth, some courts, the Third Circuit in particular, have focused on whether there was an identifiable private beneficiary whose identity was known in advance, who got the lion's share of the benefits. If we don't know the identity in advance, then that makes it less likely that it's pretextual. And finally, some courts, particularly the New York Court of Appeals in the Atlantic Yards and Columbia case, have essentially said that virtually no taking is really pretextual, and they have read Kelo's pretext limitation out of existence. I mentioned the facts of the Atlantic Yards and Columbia cases. Seems to me if there was ever a pretextual taking, it was these two cases, but the New York Court of Appeals believes otherwise. Ultimately, I think this issue of pretext will likely get back to the Supreme Court because there is a huge five-way split in the lower courts, and I think it's also possible even the Kelo itself will eventually be reconsidered, as Justice Scalia has actually publicly called for the court to that, and Justice Stevens, the author of Kelo, has just a couple years ago admitted that he made a serious error in the legal analysis that he did in the case, though he also maintains that the case was still correctly decided for reasons different from the ones that he put in the court's opinion. So, therefore, there's still a lot of action in this area. There's an ongoing story, and I very much look forward to discussing it in the question period. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. I do want to open it up for questions from the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on one second. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to pose your question. Before we go to the audience, let me check back in with Professor Ely and see, Professor, if you have anything you want to say in response to or to augment what Professor Soman said.
No, I thought Ely did an excellent job of giving us an update as to where things sit. Don't know how optimistic I am. The Supreme Court will revisit Kelo in the near future, but one can't be blamed for wishing. In any event, I would say let's go to the audience.
And Professor Soman, when you say talk about Kelo being revisited, do you mean the same case or the similar case with different participants in it, different parties?
Almost certainly the latter. There is an interesting story that we can talk about what's going on at the Kelo site itself, where after 8 years, nothing has actually been built on the condemned land, but it's unlikely that that particular case will get to the Supreme Court. But as I said, the pretext issue will likely get to the Supreme Court, and it's possible that at some point although I agree with Jim, not in the very near future, but it's possible that at some point in the future, Kelo itself, as an overall decision, would get either overruled or somehow limited.
Let me just pick up on Ilya's point, if I may, that nothing has gone on in the new London site for these many years. That's just an example of how there's a great gap between the grandiose projections of what's going to happen and the reality. Meanwhile, whole neighborhoods were destroyed. Tax base to the city has been diminished. I can't see anything positive at this point coming out of it.
There is one small positive, and that is that feral cats have been using the land. So in my book that I'm writing about Q, I'm going to have a photo of some feral cats there. And so we have, at a cost of millions of dollars and lots of litigation, created a nice home for feral cats.
Very good. Once again, if you want to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to pose a question to either of our experts. And let's go to our first question now.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. The problem in Kelo seems to have been that the Supreme Court seized on a deficit in the Connecticut Constitution that didn't specify for public use, leaving the court to try to decide whether it would follow the Connecticut Constitution or try to incorporate the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution against the state for eminent domain purposes. And that might be the way to go in the future. But I'd like the participants to comment on another problem I see in all this, and is the deficit in the various reform proposals, that they don't specify a period of time within which it must be put to public use or a period of time for which it must be kept in public use. And that leaves a broad loophole by which the property, as in the Kelo case, can be kept unused for an extended period of time, or could be used for public use for a brief period of time and then immediately sold to a private developer. So unless there are some kind of bright line rules introduced for defining the temporal bounds on public use, most reform efforts in this area are likely to be ineffectual.
So this is Professor Soman. I think the questioner raises two issues. One is the temporal question. Some state reform efforts actually do have temporal restrictions, such as in Louisiana. Others which say it must be for a public use narrowly defined, while there's not a specific temporal restriction, and courts usually do interpret that as the government can't simply take it supposedly for a public use and then almost immediately or very soon thereafter say, well, we're going to give it to a private developer to use however he wants. So there is actually, in states that are more restrictive public use jurisprudence, there is actually a good deal of precedent on that question. As to the issue of the Connecticut state constitution, of course, the takings in New London were first considered by the Connecticut Supreme Court before they went up to the federal Supreme Court, and the Connecticut Supreme Court upheld the takings only by a narrow 4-3 vote, but even the majority admitted that there are some public use constraints in the Connecticut Constitution. They just interpreted those constraints very loosely. But regardless of what the Connecticut Constitution says, the federal constitution has a public use restriction, and states have to obey the federal constitution even if they don't have similar state constitutional limits of their own.
Professor Ely, do you want to weigh in here?
Well, I think that Ilya has pretty well addressed the main points here. I would just comment in connection with the Connecticut Supreme Court. The majority opinion, and it was a sharply divided court, the majority opinion gave great weight to the decision of the Michigan Supreme Court in the Polltown case. Now, what was particularly striking about that is that shortly after the Connecticut Supreme Court decided its Kelo decision, the Supreme Court of Michigan repudiated the Polton case. One might have thought that this would have led the Connecticut Supreme Court to reconsider its decision, or at least to take account of new developments. But in any event, it wasn't to be. But they relied upon an authority line from Michigan that was ultimately repudiated in that state.
Yeah, just a few months later, actually. There is one interesting other codice, the Connecticut Supreme Court decision, which, as I said before, it was a 4-3 ruling. One of the four justices in the majority, Justice Palmer, a few years later, actually publicly apologized to Suzette Kilo, one of the property owners whose land was condemned, and he said if he had known then, at the time of the decision, what he knows now, which is that no real development was actually produced, that he would have gone the other way. Now, he claims that it was not actually possible for him to know at the time, but actually, if you look at the briefing in the case, there was a lot of evidence that the plan was dubious and that there wasn't actually a very clear or very viable agenda for what they were going to do with the property that was being condemned. And actually, the dissenting justices in their dissents or their one dissenting opinion they all signed actually pointed this out in the Connecticut Supreme Court. So, but it's interesting that at least one justice has had at least some second thoughts about the ruling he made in that case.
And to be clear, your criticism of Kilo goes further than that, that even had the development continued as planned, it would have been problematic.
I believe so, yes. But to my mind, even if you want to say that a public use is really any potential public benefit, there has to be at least some reasonable likelihood that the public benefit is actually going to be created. I think Kilo is wrong, partly because they define public use so broadly in the first place, but partly because there are no legal assurances at all that the supposed public benefit is actually going to be achieved.
Right. And we have one question pending at this point. Before we go there, I want to follow up on John Rowland's issue, the temporal issue. Have there been instances of abuse there that either of you are aware of where a government condemns a property, maybe builds a road and then turns it into a private road and sells it to a private entity or something like that?
Historically, there have been, but in most states where this kind of issue has been litigated, the state courts actually have been pretty good on this and have said that you can't do a sort of a blatantly pretextual taking like that, right? Like you can't do a bait and switch operation. I have in my files a list of Supreme Court precedents or appellate court precedents from quite a few states which deal with this. The problem in most cases is not that the state says we're going to condemn for one purpose, but actually do it for a completely different purpose. It's that there are many states where they can condemn for almost any purpose they want, so they don't actually need to lie about what they're doing. They can just say we're condemning to give to a private developer because maybe that will produce some economic benefits for a community, which the legal doctrine doesn't even require them to prove will actually be achieved.
Right. We've got one caller question pending at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Ilya. It's Dana Berliner.
Hi, Dana.
Hey, Dana.
I had to call into this one, of course. I wanted to, I guess, ask questions. One is about the recent Missouri Supreme Court decision, which I thought was interesting because that was a state with extremely weak statutory reform, but then a pretty decent state Supreme Court decision. I wanted to see what you thought of it. And then the other question had to do with the issue of really where pretext is going. And I've been mostly aware of state law rulings on pretext, but I'm wondering if maybe there's starting to be circuit splits growing, and I just wanted to ask whether you think that's something that's happening.
So on the second question, there is a circuits split in that the Second and Third Circuits have different views on this. The Third Circuit has said it's very important if there is an identifiable private beneficiary. The Second Circuit has given virtually a rubber stamp and said that you can and said that you can almost nothing is a it said it almost nothing is a pretext. There are also splits between different state Supreme Courts on this, with some state Supreme Courts using some standards and others using others. I don't have probably time in this call to go through all of this, but if you're interested, I do actually go through all the cases in my article, The Judicial Reaction to Kelo, which is available on my website. So there is not just a two-way split, but there's actually essentially a four- or five-way split between different lower federal courts and state Supreme Courts, which is why I think this ultimately will go to the federal Supreme Court to resolve, although the court has so far turned down two or three opportunities where they could have addressed this. As for the Missouri Supreme Court, I think that it has interpreted what is a relatively weak state Supreme Court, I'm sorry, what is a relatively weak post-Kelo reform law, and has given it a little bit of teeth, but it's probably only a little bit of teeth. Essentially what they've said is that there has to be at least something other than pure economic development as a rationale for condemning property. However, it doesn't seem like there actually have to be that much more than a pure claim of economic development. For instance, in this case, the court did say, I'm actually punching up the decision right now, it said that if only this taking had, quote-unquote, improved commerce on the river in question here by, quote, making such commerce easier to conduct, that would have satisfied the statute. So it has a little bit of teeth now, and more perhaps than people, including myself, expected that it would have. But I think it'll still probably be easy for skilled lawyers on behalf of condemning authorities to get around this. I think they just made not very good arguments in this case because they really thought that virtually anything would be enough. And the state Supreme Court has sort of wrapped their knuckles and said, you got to do a little better than that.
Professor Ely?
No, I have nothing to add, Dana. I think that Ilya's covered it very well.
By the way, for those of you who may not know, Dana is actually one of the lawyers for the Institute for Justice who litigated the Kelo case in both the federal and state Supreme Courts.
Once again, our phone lines are now wide open. We have nobody pending in terms of questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if we get another question, let me ask you a follow-up question. You mentioned, Ilya, that the Supreme Court had turned down a couple opportunities to revisit these issues. You want to venture a guess? Either one of you want to venture a guess on when it will come back before the Supreme Court? I think you both seem pretty sure that it will come back, but...
if I had to guess, I think sometime within the next 4 to 5 years, because they're just such a mess in the lower courts, it's unusual for the Supreme Court to allow a big mess like that to persist for a really long time. However, there is always the chance that there is a block of justices on the court that just don't want to take this issue, no matter how big a mess it is. For what it's worth, Justice Alito has said in a dissent to denial of certiorari that he wrote in the Atlantic Yards case, I believe it was, that he thinks the Supreme Court should address this. So we know there's at least some justices who want to deal with it, but so far there haven't been four in any one case. Another possible theory is that they're waiting for a case that somehow has a particular set of facts that they're looking for.
Yes, I wouldn't be betting the family farm on their revisiting the Kelo problem in the next couple of years, but sooner or later the right case will come along, and hopefully the right block of justices will be there to grant review.
Okay. Well, you might need to bet the family farm before somebody takes it from you. But
yeah. So I think even if they don't reconsider the overall holding in QO, the issue of what counts as a pretext, I think, is one they have a good likelihood of considering, simply because we do have this five-way division in the lower courts, and there's no sign of any kind of consensus emerging on it at either the state Supreme Court level or in lower federal courts.
We might be sparking some questions here. There's a couple of callers now with questions. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland back. In Texas, we have ingenious ways of pretexting. A popular method, which probably raises issues that related to the core issue of this call, session, is using public eminent domain for a highway, which is then contracted to a tolling company, in effect making him the de facto owner of the road for tolling purposes, and also having a right-of-way that's wide enough to include the commercial roadside development sites along both sides of the highway, which are then, of course, sold to favored buyers, instead of allowing the property owners who originally owned the land to reap a benefit by developing it themselves. So there are many ways that corrupt politicians can get around the restrictions that have traditionally been used that probably ought to be addressed in any reform legislation.
So I think this raised two interesting issues. One is the question of what happens if it is for a traditional public use, like a road or a bridge or the like, but a private firm gets to own and operate it and collect tolls. I actually am not sure that's necessarily such a problem, so long as the public really still does have a right to use the road, as I think in these cases they do. The private company may in some case actually operate the land more efficiently and price the tolls better than the government would. I think there's studies that suggest this to be the case. Obviously, there can still be corruption, and the road might be more costly than whatever benefits it creates, but it's not, I think, inherently not a public use when you have a public road which is operated by a private company. The second issue is what eminent domain lawyers call excess condemnation. What if there is a legitimate public use, but the government condemns more property than is really necessary to accomplish it, and the additional property is used by some private interest? States, I think, differ significantly on how tough they are in blocking excess condemnations. And I think, obviously, a more stringent doctrine is warranted here, in that whatever a public use is, it can only authorize you to condemn enough property to actually carry out the public use. You shouldn't be allowed to condemn a bunch of other property that just happens to be nearby so as to give away to your favored cronies. So I think the problem of excess condemnation is a real problem, but there actually are a lot of states where there's pretty good judicial precedent, which says essentially, look, you can't in fact help yourself to additional land that goes beyond what is actually needed for your public use.
Professor Ely, I entirely agree with what you said about the excess condemnation. The comment about the private road, though, is very interesting one, because it harks back to 19th century takings law, in which it was pretty well established very early that it was consistent with even a narrow reading of public use. To have public projects such as roads, railroads, canals, bridges, maintained by a private entity. For a lot of good economic reasons, many state governments decided that actually it was more efficient and better served the public interest to have a private party operate a railroad or a bridge. That did not raise any great difficulty for most commentators or jurists in the 19th century, because all these facilities were open to the public. You had to pay the toll, of course, or the fare, but they were all open to the public, and they were all to serve the public. They were not just like any other private business. And so whether a state decided to build its own railroad, as a few tried in the 19th century, or charter a private company to build a railroad, that was not the key issue. The key issue was whether it was open to the public use. And so I see no particular objection if a state decided to have eminent domain utilized to facilitate a road to be operated by a private turnpike company, for example. We had a lot of those in the 19th century.
Just to add one small point to what Jim said, there are some state Supreme Courts which have constrained takings for roads, which really are essentially private in that they're built in such a way that really only one particular individual or one firm would ever actually be able to use them. So, for instance, the Michigan Supreme Court in the Tolksdorf case, I believe in 1993, though I could be wrong about the exact date, struck down a condemnation for a road like that. So if it really is a road which is essentially for the use of only one person or only one firm, then that's, I think, a different case. But if it's a public road where the general public has a right to use it, the fact that it's operated by a private company, I think, isn't necessarily a problem. It could even in some cases be a good thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry if anything I said left an ambiguity there. As I pointed out, in the 19th century, New York court wouldn't let you build a private road, meaning a road only to benefit one person. But a privately operated road open to the general public would pass muster, so far as I know, any court in the 19th century, and say nothing of today.
Looks like we have a final question. We probably have time for more than just one question. If you have a question you'd like to pose, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Bill Severson in Seattle. And I'm sorry, I missed some of the discussion, so I hope I'm not revisiting already plowed ground. But I was wondering if you could comment on whether or not there's any possibility of reviving the distinction at the federal level between public purpose and public use, and sort of a solid basis for making that distinction.
So I think there is, in that if you look at the Kelo decision, it was a close 5-4 decision where the four dissenting justices led by Justice O'Connor all, in fact, wanted to revive that very distinction, at least to some degree. So whereas before Kelo, most experts thought, well, this is a dead issue. Everybody agrees the public purpose is the test, and the public use is almost anything the legislature says it is. Now there is real dispute over this issue. As I said before, Justice Scalia said he wants Kelo to be overruled. Doesn't necessarily mean that it will be overruled, but I think it does mean that this is now an issue that's in play, that sort of serious people and serious judges disagree over. And if you think that public use is something narrower than public purpose and it should be enforced by the Supreme Court, you're no longer a weird right-wing extremist if you think that. Now sort of ordinary mainstream people like Justice O'Connor believe things like that. So don't know if it will actually happen, but is there a real chance? Yeah, I think there is.
Yes, I would like to emphasize that one of the most important, I think, consequences, positive consequences, has been this enormous change in the literature, an enormous change in at least some state courts about receptivity to public use challenges. This issue was widely regarded as dead in the 1940s and 50s. There was even a famous Law Review article, a requiem for the public use requirement, suggesting basically the ball game was over. Well, as Yogi Berra says, it's not over till it's over. And I think that while we've been discouragements, of course, we have to consider that this issue has now been put back into public and academic dialogue. And I think that's an important step toward ultimately vindicating the rights of individual property owners.
Yeah, it's worth noting that even in the 10 years right before Kelo, there were several state Supreme Courts, including the Michigan Supreme Court, that had struck down economic development takings under their state constitution. So there was a pre-existing trend in the state Supreme Courts. What happens in the state Supreme Courts doesn't necessarily always influence the federal Supreme Court, but There's an issue, and certainly the federal Supreme Court is not required at all to follow those state courts, but there's an issue here about the sort of culture of the legal and judicial profession that, unlike, say, 30 or 40 years ago, it is now broadly respectable in the legal profession among the elites of this business to be a person who believes that public use is a strong, meaningful constraint on takings. And that's a big change, and it suggests that, you know, maybe QO will survive, but it's by no means a sure thing that it will.
Looks like we're out of questions for now, but let me ask one question that might be a bit far afield, and in answering, you can take an opportunity to give us your final thoughts or wrap up, and we'll conclude the call. In my experience, the Kelo case produced more backlash than any other Supreme Court case, and since then, we've had a lot of studies, a lot of discussion on the amount of faith or the positive feelings of the public toward the court, or negative feelings toward the court and other institutions of government. Have there been any other studies on trying to pull out different threads of why the court's popular or unpopular? And has this case in particular been identified as something that diminished the esteem in which people hold the court?
So there is a large literature on judicial popularity. And the court's popularity in general over the last 2 or 3 years has gone down. However, it's hard to say whether the Kelo case played a big role in that. In the immediate aftermath of Kelo, in the, say, the year right after, it doesn't seem like the court's general popularity suffered a lot. One possible way of looking at this is people thought, well, they badly screwed up in this one case, but in general, we think the justices are pretty good. Today, over the last 2 or 3 years, the court's popularity has diminished for various reasons. It's hard to say that Kelo has played a big role in that. So even though Kelo was perhaps the most widely unpopular Supreme Court decision in many years, if not ever, ironically, it played relatively little role in damaging the court's overall reputation, possibly because what really often damages the court's reputation with groups is thinking, well, the court is on the, like, I'm a Republican and I think the court is on the side of Democrats, really, or vice versa. Ironically, because this decision was so widely unpopular among both Republicans and Democrats, it didn't readily play into a narrative of the court being against us and supporting our political enemies.
Interesting. Professor Ely, a final thought here.
Let me just add, in connection with court popularity, I don't think most of the general public follows Supreme Court decisions on a day-in, day-out basis. And indeed, many of the decisions are of no great interest to much of the general public on a day-in, day-out basis. I do think high-visibility opinions, same-sex marriage, let's say, recently, gets people riled up, and they get lined up on one side or another, and all they really want to know is the court on my side? I think that these popularity surveys are rather fleeting in my mind because they're very result-oriented. And I doubt there's any way we could identify that Kelo itself contributed to a diminution of court popularity, because I think that the public tends to react very viscerally to some lines of decision-making, and it may also be fleeting. Today, if we took a poll, a lot of people might not even have heard of Kelo. So I'm just very skeptical that you can read the popularity opinions as really having a lot of weight.
So I think this is true. A 2009 survey conducted by, I think, scholars at Columbia and Harvard did find that a large percentage of the public didn't know or remember which way the Supreme Court had gone on this issue. On the other hand, that survey taken several years after Kelo still showed that over 80% of the public is against allowing the government to take property for economic development and give it to private parties.
So
opposition to this sort of practice has remained consistent. I think, as you say, it's also true that the public is often result-oriented, though there are also surveys which show that the public has opinions on what the justices' methodology should be as well. There's actually a very close division between those people in the public who are originalists, in effect, and those who believe in some kind of more of a living constitution model.
Oh, let me be very clear. I quite agree with Ilya that the public remains very much opposed to these private development takings as we saw in Kelo. But I thought the question pertained to the court's popularity as such, as distinct from an issue. And I think the popularity polls, to me, just a result orientation and are quite fleeting.
I think that's largely true, although over time, there sometimes is a cumulative effect, and I think it's interesting and important that for many years, the court actually has had higher approval ratings than in most of the time than Congress and the president do. Over the last couple of years, that gap has narrowed considerably, though they're still somewhat more popular than Congress and the president, in part because Congress is so enormously unpopular.
Well, I think that that is true. I personally think Congress is being somewhat unfairly beaten up by the public that seems to want them at once to compromise and yet stand up on their principles at the same time.
I'm not saying the public is necessarily right to hate Congress as much as they do, but they clearly don't like them.
No, they clearly don't. They're clearly down on Congress. But I think all the institutions of government have been suffering in recent years.
Yes, that's true.
The president's ratings are down. Congress is very down. Court, no doubt, is down. But maybe the court is down because some people didn't like the same-sex marriage rulings. I mean, it's so hard to read it, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen,
yeah, I agree.
I have gotten us off track here a while, and
sure.
It looks like we're just about out of time. But on behalf of the Federalist Society, I do want to thank both of you, Professor James Ely and Professor Ilya Selman, for participating today. This has been a very interesting discussion. Perhaps we can revisit it if a case begins moving towards the court, or even sooner if something else breaks in terms of news. To our audience, of course, thank you for dialing in, and thank you for your participation as well. I invite you to check the Federalist Society website and monitor your emails for information about upcoming teleforum conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.